Welcome to Morph Into a New You, part of MHNRnetwork.com. Your host, Johnny Calloway, is the author of several books, including Taming the Dragon, Dragons to Butterflies, The Metamorphosis of a Man, and The Bridge. He will be having conversations with people from all walks of life. Healing really is an inside job that transforms you to become a better version of you. We must change our self-talk and inner dialogue so we can start to believe. A special thanks to our sponsor, Meaningful Expressions, at m-expressions.com. They can take a concept, thought, or personal brand and turn it into a visual masterpiece that you can use to raise awareness about your passion or cause. They've certainly done that with our podcast website. And thank you for joining Johnny as you morph into a new you.
Hello, everybody. This is Johnny Calloway, host of Morph Into a New You podcast, part of Mental Health News Radio Network, and grateful to be there. I want to send out a big thank you to Kristen Sinatra Walker for creating the platform for these voices to be heard and all the people that her program, the network, is helping to better themselves with. Today, we have Dr. Eric Gentry with us again, my most recurring guest, and I just love to have conversations with Eric. And today, we're going to talk about the third step of the 12, made the decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. And I can't wait to see what comes from Eric on this, because it'll be a wealth of information. How you doing, Eric?
I'm grand.
Good deal.
It's early here in Phoenix.
Yeah, what is it there, like 8?
It's 8, yeah.
Well, I'm glad we didn't try to do it at my 8.
So, but I've got my Starbucks, and all is good in the world.
Right. Well, I got my Wawa. So I live about a quarter of a mile from a Wawa. I've got a Wawa right here on the desk. All right, Eric, we're going to go at it, man. Like, made the decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God. I believe the principle of that step is trust. And man, it's a huge, huge, huge part of 12-step recovery. I think it's a huge part of recovery, period. If you don't go to the 12 steps, you still need to learn to trust something. And if you've been traumatized at any point in your life, at some point there's got to be hope, which we talked about in the second step. And then hopefully that hope turns to trust. Eric, give me your synopsis of the third step in general.
Okay, I will. So to describe the third step, I would start with Henry Nouwen, who's one of my kind of favorite writers. And for me, I was really struggling with turning my will and my life over to a power that I saw my father's face on. I couldn't, and my father did as a child, he would set me up frequently to be in competition with him, and then he would always win. And so it was always a setup for me, and it was painful. So that's how I saw God. And I was talking with my sponsor about it, and she was, I may have talked to her about her on this show before. This was back in the late 90s. And she was a four-pack-a-day Winston smoker and a stone-cold bingo junkie. And the only way I could talk to her was I had to go to the bingo hall, and she'd say, play a freaking card. And so I'd sit there and play a bingo card with her while I was sharing my stuff. And I shared with her about this. And she was, you know, she had one of those stampers that you stamp the cards, and she was stamping away. She had 10 cards playing. And she stopped after I said that. She turned around and looked at me, and she said, you need a new effing God.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Well, and I'll cut to the chase on that. That's such a great story that I wanted to tell it. And so what happened was I started kind of separating that, started discerning that, you know, that loving a power greater than me that's loving, caring, doesn't want to hurt me. And what a friend of mine who's a pastor and psychologist in Puerto Rico, he gave me a book called The Return of the Prodigal Son. In that book, Henry Now, it's just one of the most beautiful little books that I've ever read on spiritual maturation. And he talks about the role of spiritual maturation through the three characters in The Prodigal Son, about how we got to catch ourselves sleeping with the swine, that we have to find ourselves having disinherited and acted in ways that we don't want to be. And we got to come back home. And we got to come back home with humility that I don't come back home entitled. I come back home saying, you know, I effed up. And can I have a little bit? Can I stay in the stable? And to find ourselves being welcomed home by, you know, a loving father that envelops us in his arms. And, you know, that's what it's been like for me in the recovery community. That's what it's been like for me in my spirit. And to have enough of those experiences of where I am going back out again and engaging in behaviors that I don't like when I do them, and then coming back to find myself loved and cared for by a power greater than myself, that's what has built the third step foundation for me.
There's so much I related to there. I had someone tell me right after I first got into the 12 steps that, unfortunately, and in my case it was unfortunately, when we think of God as children, we give God the same attributes that our authoritative parent has. So when you have a parent such as my dad, that doesn't make God a good guy. And I did everything I could to keep from going to my dad for help because it never ended up good. So it made it difficult for me to turn to God when I needed help. So when I came to the program, my biggest resentment actually was with God. And he came in front of my dad, actually. It's like all this stuff was on him. So fortunately, and I've said this on several of my shows before, my first sponsor, our friend Ed, after listening to me carry on my dissertation for about 45 minutes, all my thoughts about God, he said, it might behoove you to be open to the idea that perhaps everything you think you know about God could be wrong. That gave me a clean slate of my ideas, my beliefs about God, so that I could build. And that's one of the beautiful things about the 12 steps. There's this one point that is repeated. There's actually two, but the one we're talking about now is as we understood him. And it's not only repeated in 3 and 11, it's underlined in both cases. So that tells me there's some real importance to that as we understood him. So I got to, over the course of the next many years, still developing actually, build my own belief system. I got through my inventories, I've been able to investigate, is that a belief that I really believe, that I operated my whole life from? And most of the time for me, it was, no, I don't really believe that. That's not a God that I want to turn to. That's not a higher power or whatever. So I love in the third step that we begin to build something that actually works for us. Because in my world, God was not working for me. He was, seriously, if I get real honest, as a child, I had a picture of God in my mind because I thought, and I sometimes, most of the time, I still think in pictures. And I had this picture of God with his long flowing white beard and his white robe, and he's standing on a cloud with a lightning bolt in his hand. And above his head, it says, go ahead, make my day. And I really believed he was out to get me. And I never understood why, because it started at a time in my life. My mom died when I was 5. So anyway, today I have my own understanding, and it's been built from those, from the rooms of the 12 steps. I get to listen to what you say and what somebody else says, and I'm like, oh, I want some of that. Don't want any of that. And I get to build my own thing.
Amen. from the choir.
There is a section in the teacher's manual, and I know you've worked with A Course in Miracles before, but the first of God's characteristics that it talks about in the teacher's manual of A Course in Miracles, from which it says all the other characteristics of a teacher of God stands on, is trust. Generosity, patience, all of that aren't really possible without trust. The thing that I love is in the first thing it talks about is the development of trust. And it literally talks about finding a bottom, because it goes, it says we must go through a period of undoing. And the summation of that is we must find a bottom so we can start learning what's valuable in life and what's not, because we've made idols out of so many things. And it doesn't have to be drugs and alcohol, but it can be. It can be your job. It can be your relationships. We put so many things ahead of what would be saving us. What's your thoughts on that?
You know, I was thinking of when you asked me at the very onset of the show about my understanding of the third step, to not be long-winded, I didn't grab that. But, you know, I'm thinking about that the third step decision requires a visceral felt sense of coming to understand that I am not a very good God. And there's nothing more that I want than to be my own God.
Right.
That's, if I could nail addiction to the wall, that's what addiction is. It is the desire to be our own God.
Wow.
And I see people in the world who seemingly are able to do that. But, you know, what's happened, the gift, we call it the gift of desperation. You know, that gift of desperation is what yanks us out of the belief that I can run my own life. That when I run my own life, things go sideways and I end up in the ditch. I mean, and I've had that experience for 30 years in recovery. So what that does is that makes me willing to start to experiment with new ways. And I love that there is the buffer between one and three is two. And two is the experimentation with finding a power greater than myself. You know, it is beginning to, you know, what my sponsor asked me to do was to start with a scale that was balanced, and that there is no loving God and that there is a loving God on those two scales, and it's balanced. And he said, what I want you to do for the next 90 days is to ask every morning for God to reveal God's self to you.
Nice.
And see what happens. And you know what happened over those 90 days was I got overwhelming evidence that there was something working in my life that was not working before I was aware of it. Wow. And the more that I sought whatever that thing was, the more I experienced some organizing principle that loved me and was carrying me towards something better. So my decision in the third step was based on evidence, not trust. It was a accumulation of enough things that had happened in my life that, you know, I was kind of like what when Dick Cavett asked Carl Jung, do you believe in God? And Carl Jung pops his pipe and lights it up on stage and says, believe? No, I don't believe. I know.
Right.
And that's when a third step, when a second step is done right, the third step decision is it's not trust, it's knowledge.
I like that. I've said a blue million times about trust, belief, all that. People say they want to see God. They want to see something. And my thing is like, if you're sitting enough of these damn meetings and you've been paying attention at all to what's going on, that guy that came in here with no shoes or just a pair of flip-flops, those the only shoes he had, and you watch him and he could not look you in the eye. He could not carry on a conversation with you. And you watch his process. Where next thing you know, he's got a pair of shoes. Next thing you know, he's not identifying you by your shoes. He can actually look up and look at you and have a conversation with you. If you can't see God in these rooms, you're not looking. Because it's so, and the guy that came in and he couldn't even utter the words, I'm Billy Bob and I'm an addict, or I'm Billy Bob and I'm an alcoholic. He couldn't say that. I have a thing about the I am thing for myself today personally, but at the same time, I need an identifier. And today, it's like I know by saying that, it makes me a part of something much bigger than me. I see God every time I go to a meeting. When I see that girl that 6 weeks ago I saw standing on a street corner trying to trade herself out for her next hit, and now I see her in here with her child sitting in her lap, and she's sitting there, and she's being a mother to the best of her ability. There's some kind of force working there that's way bigger than me, man. And it also ties into one of my little lines I love to use, and that is, we don't see what we look at, we see what we look for. Prior to getting into the 12 steps, I was looking for reasons not to believe in God so that I could feel I was a victim to random acts of madness.
Uh-huh.
And once I got in the program and I started wanting to be a part of what happens in those rooms, I started looking for reasons to believe. And coming from that place, they were everywhere. The fact that I could go work an 8-hour day and just turn in the 8 hours and not try to get an extra 2 on the card. The fact that I went to work, that was something bigger than me working, man. And today I look at my life and being able to have conversations with you and other people like you that, well, there's not really anybody else like you, but it's like, oh my God, how did I get here? Well, my God is how I got here. It's how I do what I do. It's huge, man, in my life. And there's another line in A Course in Miracles that I love, and it says, all things are healed through trust. I can't even add to that.
Well, I can a little.
Okay, go.
And do it from a scientific perspective.
Okay.
Physiological perspective, because that's been the fun part about becoming a scientist, is to see how that what we're learning about brain and body physiology just so much support what 12 steps have evolved, you know, intuitively into. But anybody who's ever been traumatized, anybody who's ever been hurt, the result of that hurting is the development of a state of hypervigilance, is being on guard. And the more a person's been hurt, the more that they are in a state of being on guard, and that is constricted muscles that's scanning the environment. And what that means is that the person now cannot focus on their intention because they are perceiving so much threat that survival has trumped their intention of them being who they want to be in relationships, working towards a career, developing a hobby, having a family. They can't do that because they are perceiving so much threat. Now, what's really cool that we've learned in the past 10 years is you can't stop yourself from perceiving the threat. It bypasses the brain. It goes immediately to what's called subcortical on a route that does not go through the prefrontal cortex. So we don't have consciousness of it. Your body, your animals already responded to the perceived threat in the environment. And by the time we get into the rooms, we have millions of painful learning experiences, which cause us to perceive a really dangerous world. And we've taken dope or drank alcohol as a way of coping with that state of being jacked up all the time. So as I teach folks to dial down their arousal, to walk into situations that they are afraid of while being in a relaxed body, that's what heals trauma, is that you can't be in distress in a relaxed body. You can't have distress and release muscles in your body simultaneously. And the more that a person practices that self-regulation of lowering their arousal by releasing the constriction of their muscles, the better their life gets. But check this. I've had combat veterans that my ex-wife, who was a psychiatrist, put on Klonopin, and they would bring back the bottles of Klonopin and set them on her desk and say, I can't take these. They make me too anxious.
Wow.
I scratched my head about that. And the more traumatized the person was, the more she would prescribe them medicine, and they couldn't take it because it made them anxious. And, you know, after spending time with three or four of those folks, what I started learning was that they perceive relaxation as a threat. That is the relinquishing of their armor and their weapons. And now they're going out into a dangerous world where they don't have resources to protect themselves.
Wow.
I'll finish this up and then I'll want your comments. As I've taught people to go out into the world and begin to intervene with that threat response by relaxing every single time that they encounter something in the world that they perceive as threatening, what happens is there's a spontaneous movement to spiritual maturation. They can't do it unless they come to believe in something that the world's not going to fall on their head in the next 5 seconds, that they can let go. And that's really cool to see that happening from the other way. Instead of coming at it from a spiritual standpoint, which is what we do in the 12 steps, watching folks as they begin to self-regulate, they spontaneously reach to a belief system that's going to keep them from getting dead in the next 5 seconds.
Wow.
What's your thoughts on that, Johnny?
Well, I've been involved with the 12 steps for 34 years now. And in the observation of that time, what has always been incredibly curious to me is we talk about the avoidance of the fourth and fifth step, and we make that a huge thing, and that is big because a lot of people just don't want to go there. But in my mind, there's another step that gets incredibly avoided, and that's step 11. I know people, myself included, multiple years clean, ain't going to meditation, man. Ain't going to sit down and just try to be still and be quiet. I remember in my early recovery, people would talk about serenity and tranquility and peace of mind. It sounded freaking boring to me, man. I'm like, who wants to do that? I do. But what you just said, all of that makes so much sense in that I understand a little better now why we, us addicts, alcoholics, gamblers, whatever, avoid that because it's frightening. It's like, if I let down my guard, which is basically what it is, my summation of what I just heard you say, if I let down my guard and relax, what's going to protect me? What's going to keep me safe? And if I don't turn to that power that we're talking about, nothing. Because I have repeated evidence that I can't keep me safe on my own. Takes me back to one of the things that you said to me when I was working with you that made all the difference in the world in my life. When after my going on and on with you, crying my eyes out, telling you what was going on in my world, and you looked at me and said, you're not going to like what I got to say. And I said, that probably means I need to hear it. And then you said, and I hope I never forget this, and if I can say it without crying, that'll be different. You said, you don't know who God is. And until you get God in this mix, you're going to stay effing nuts. And then you directed me to start writing letters. Somebody said, actually, you told me to write a letter. I wrote them for 5 years. But you directed me to write a letter to myself from God. And that's where I reconnected. I say reconnected, and the connection I have with God today is not a reconnection, because I had never had a connection like that before I wrote those letters. But in that place, that was my quiet time. Writing those letters, that was my time of me being still and letting my guard down. And that's what I heard from what you just said. Relax. Let your guard down. There's nothing to protect yourself from. Turn it over and let him guide you. Is that pretty much what you were just saying?
That's exactly what I was saying. And I was thinking about, in that state of hypervigilance, what's happening is I'm my own God. As I stay hard with the armor, with the weapons in my hand, and go out in a world where there's danger, then what happens is I'm not seeking connection with a power greater than myself. I'm seeking to protect myself from dangers that are not real. And I was thinking about, you know how I've got I'm enamored a little bit with Carl Jung, who Bill called the spiritual father of the 12 steps. And the last book that Carl Jung wrote in his life, he wrote a preface for that book. It was actually published posthumously. And the preface of the book said, you know, I'll probably be ridiculed for the rest of eternity for writing this book, but it is what is my truth, and I need to say it before I die. The book's called An Answer to Job, and it is trying to make sense through Job's eyes of why God was punishing Job. And what Jung comes up with, the hypothesis and what he believes, is that when God was punishing Job, what Job did was stayed faithful in a relationship with God. And what that did was that created a feedback loop. So God was just kind of blind and not self-conscious. But as he was hurting Job, Job was asking for mercy back from God. And God started feeling what he was doing to Job, and he stopped. And that was what Jung believed, that was where God became sentient. God became self-aware. And he kind of makes an argument all the way through the New Testament. And what Jung believes, and this is how I work my third step and why I have such a cool relationship with God today, is that Jung believes that we, human beings, are God's senses. We are the nose and the mouth and the feelers of God. And that the only way God can experience creation is through us being in a relationship with him. So the more that we seek conscious contact in the 11th step, the more God gets to experience the beauty of his creation, which means that God starts using us more. So when I hear, you know, God's a sucker for gratitude in meetings, that's what I think happens, is that the more that I seek God, the more that God uses me, and we are in a reciprocal relationship that's more than just grace. I got a job to do, which is to let God experience the world through me. And the more I do that, the better my life gets. So is that a myth? Absolutely. But I'm in harmony with that myth and feel pretty good about where I've gotten to around that. Uh-huh.
Wow.
So it's not trust. It's a relationship.
Right.
Mutually beneficial.
Wow. I'm going to chew on that. That's a new way for me to look at it. I'm going to chew on that. In that section in A Course in Miracles where it talks about the development of trust, and this is where I tied this into our 12 steps. It says that we must go through a period of undoing, and it says it usually not be painful, but it usually is so experienced.
It usually is what?
It's so experienced. It is usually painful. That's when we attain that gift of desperation.
That's right.
But what happens is, here it says, it seems as if things are being taken away, and it is rarely understood initially that their lack of value is merely being recognized. And then it talks about, how can lack of value be perceived unless the perceiver is in a position where he must see things in a different light? Okay, to me, that's all about finding a bottom, where I finally say, I can't do this. I was one of the lucky ones when I started going to the program. There was one thing before I ever went to my first meeting that I was convinced of. Convinced. And that is, my way's not working. About anything. About how I was working in my relationship with my wife at the time. How I was doing jobs. None of it was working for me. From that place, I could learn. That's why when somebody said to me, like Ed said that thing about it might behoove you to be open to the idea. If I hadn't reached the place of knowing my way wasn't working, I wouldn't have looked for another way to work. So that's all huge to me, man. That is huge to me. And here's the thing where a lot of people really, they say, I hear a lot of people in our rooms say this, and I know that initially I didn't understand the magnitude of it. I think there's a lot of people that don't. Desperation is truly a gift.
No doubt.
And if we choose to utilize it as a gift it is, the world is open to us. And if we choose to feel a victim to it, that we're just, life just, there is no gravity, the earth just sucks. If that's the stand we take on it, guess what? We're going to get more desperation. That is real. I remember my sponsor in Kentucky saying to a guy one time, he said, you know, there's one thing. He said, we can do all kinds of stuff for each other in these rooms, but there is one gift that we cannot give each other, and that is the gift of willingness. He said, this kid, I'm standing there listening to this conversation with this other sponsor that kept relapsing. And Gerald said to him, he said, that thing about the gift of willingness, we can't give it. He said, but enough Jack Daniels can. In essence, what he was saying, enough pain might give you the willingness to listen to the people in these rooms. But until you've done that, I'm going to use my phrase now, we're just pissing up a rope.
That's right.
Because without that willingness, here's the most important part to me, how willingness ties into the open-mindedness that we need. Until I'm willing to say, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe this idea that I have about what God is and how God works, and maybe that's not it. Really, all it takes is maybe. I don't have to say, hey, I'm wrong. I just have to be willing to say, hey, I'm wrong. That makes sense?
It surely does. And what I'm thinking about is that I don't know anybody that can get that in isolation. You know, the magic, it's the interplay between a force that is somewhere that is caring for us, which is that thing we call God in the 12 steps. And then there is the manifestation of that thing, which is the love of other people in those rooms, connecting with each other, and how that becomes the firmament of God, how that my relationships in recovery and having people there for me thousands of times. One of my songs that I've written with Clean Music is, everything I know about love I've learned right here with you. Everything I know about God comes from that place too. That everything I know about the love of God has come from another recovering person in my life, at least early on. And that relational connection is the opposite of addiction. Connecting right with another human being that loves me and that wants to help me is the opposite of what I'm doing when I'm practicing addiction, whether that's with chemicals, as I used to do, or the other play things that I do now when I isolate.
Right.
Food or spending or whatever else.
Mm-hmm. You know, I said many, many years ago to my uncle, who was a devout Baptist, I said something about hell, and he said, you don't believe in hell? I said, of course I do. I've been there. And he said, what do you mean? And for me today, to tie that into active addiction and what hell is whenever I'm disconnected. Whenever I'm disconnected, I'm in a certain type of hell. Now, there's varying levels of that. And all of my addictions are about disconnection. Anything
Amen.
That distracts me from my connection to you, from my connection to my fellow man, for me, my connection to my butterflies and my aquarium and plants that I work with, I need connection. And for me, since I brought that up, for me, being connected to our planet in some way, to nature in some way, is really important to me. You know, when I take 30 minutes to go out and pull the caterpillars off of a plant before the wasp or the geckos or the ants get to them, I'm connected. And when I'm taking them and putting them in a cage where they are protected and safe from that, I'm connected. When I feed my fish in my aquarium and then I sit there for 10 minutes and watch them, I'm connected. Yeah, for me, addiction, if you're going to try to, as you say, nail addiction to the wall, for me, it's disconnection. And it is hell. And for me, that's, you know, talk about an eternity in hell. Imagine an eternity of being disconnected. I don't want it.
Have you read Gabor, G-A-B-O-R, Mate, M-A-T-E?
No.
Worth a read, because it really describes that whole process. He's a recovering physician who went and practiced medicine with Skid Row in Vancouver. And that's what he comes up with, that is the cause and the outcome of addiction, that disconnection. It's called the book, beautiful title. It's the best title I've ever heard. In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts. That's pretty good, isn't it?
Yeah.
Of hungry ghosts. I have been in the realm of hungry ghosts.
Oh, man.
I have been a hungry ghost.
Well, you know, when I tie that back to what you and I have talked about several times, and that's traumatization. It makes sense because when, I mean, it's just so practical when you stand back and try to get the bigger picture of it. It's like, okay, I'm traumatized. I'm robbed of hope. That was one of the first things you said in our first show. I'm robbed of hope and the world becomes a dangerous place.
That's right.
Okay, so why would I want to connect with anybody from that place? In my mind today, as a result of the conversations we've had and the other podcasts I've done and just living life, that is an open door to addiction because the only hope I have is connection, but who the hell am I going to connect with when I think everybody's out to get me? When I think everybody has their own personal agenda and that I'm at the bottom of the list, why would I want to connect with anybody in that place? So, yeah, to me, that trauma, and we talked about this in that first show, that trauma is an open door to addiction to anything, whether it be relationships, anything. And it's like, okay, what I love about what I get to do in my life today is I get to have these conversations with you and with the other people that I work with. I feel pretty comfortable in my understanding of life, but I love being open that there's always more for me to learn. So more and more as I age and grow, the pieces to the puzzle that are, sometimes I don't even realize the piece has been missing in the puzzle. And then somebody will say something like, when you're traumatized, you're robbed of hope. And I'm like, oh my God. And the world becomes an unsafe place. You react to everything from a state of jack-upness. And I mean, as soon as you said that in that first show, I'm like, yep, that's me. That is me, man. That's how I lived my life. Nothing was safe. Nothing was to be trusted. Now here we are many, many, many years later, many falling down, me getting up. I know today I'm okay. I'm not going to lie. I've been personally going through a tough time with what I'm trying to do with my writings and with my podcast and all that. There's a lot that I just don't know about how to actually get this message that you and I are having out, because that's what I want. I want this stuff that I do with you and with so many others to actually be heard, because I know it helps people. I know there's people out there right now struggling with the third step that really need to hear what we just had to say. I know that. Because, man, if some of this information had been given to me earlier, A Course in Miracles says that the purpose of a teacher of God is to collapse time. And it says the purpose of a teacher of God is to save time. I've had people say to me after reading my book, man, I want what you got. And I'm like, did you read that book? It took me 34 years. You don't necessarily want to do just what I did. Because part of my purpose writing that book is to help you get there quicker than I did. To give you some insights that you don't have to live through all that pain to get. Yeah, I love what we do, Eric. I love what you do.
Hard part, Johnny. The hard part is continuing to embrace. Here it is. Get ready for it. It's coming. The hard part is to embrace the outcomes are none of my damn business.
You know, when I started this month, I knew I wanted the theme for the month on Morph Into a New You to be trust and turning it over. What I wanted to put out there, and people that work with me said, maybe you don't want to do that way. Well, I'm going to put it out there now anyway. It's just part of the show. But when you do a third step, when I work with somebody that's beginning their third step, what I say is, okay, you better hold on because shit's about to get different. Because, you know, I think one of the mistakes we make with the third step is we have this hidden idea, especially new on the path, so to speak, is we have this hidden idea that if I turn my life over to God, that things are going to get euphoric. And that ain't the case, man. When I say to God, take me and do with me as you would so that I can learn what you would have me learn and be what you would have me be, when I say that, I got some lessons coming. Because the only thing he really needs me to help him do is to help his other children. And the best way for me to do that is to experience what they're going through. So I'm telling you, man, I remember I did that prayer, just what I just said to you, every day for 2 weeks while reading the book, The Junkie Priest, and being so inspired by Father Dan Egan's willingness to give, no matter what the cost was to him on a personal level. I wanted that so bad. So take me and do with me what you would. I had no idea what the hell I was doing when I was doing that. Or no idea what was to come after that. But I had some hard lessons to learn. One was I had to go back to Kentucky and live with my dad in the same trailer that I grew up in so I could forgive him in that space. Oh, my God. If God had said to me in that moment that I was saying that prayer, okay, you're going back to your dad, dude, I'd been like, no. But I wouldn't trade anything for those experiences today. Yeah, the development of trust and development of knowing that it works.
You know what a koan is, right? That K-O-A-N. It's what the bodhisattvas are given in the year of their silence before enlightenment. That they give them a riddle that they meditate on that's unsolvable. The big one, you know, in the Buddhist to history is what's the sound of one hand clapping? And, you know, it just runs them around and leads to the disentanglement of thought. And that's the purpose of doing that. Well, in the fellowship that I attend, there is a piece of literature that has always been that, a sentence that's always been a koan to me in recovery. And it really is lined with what you just said. And the quote from that literature is, "When my spiritual needs are met, all of my other problems are reduced to a level of comfort."
Wow, I like that.
Yeah, wow. And when I am able to seek the spiritual solution in world problems, what I do is I let the hell go. And when I let the hell go, I'm not in distress anymore. It stops being a problem. It's a walkthrough. And it always ends up being something better.
Right.
It's just, it's my fear and my squeezing and muscling through those situations that turn it into pain. When I let go and take the third to the 11th step route, then I walk through the valley of the shadow of death. I walk through the scary shit and I'm not in distress anymore. And that's pretty amazing, is that I don't have to suffer.
Wow.
And I do. It's a paradox. You know, it's a beautiful paradox because I can't get to doing that unless I've suffered enough from not doing it.
I'm going to tag in here, man. I got to. I think the highly evolved, not saying myself, get to a place where they understand that the suffering. Okay, we've already said that desperation is a gift. Well, that doesn't stop because we decide to start doing something different. So pain, there's a line in the Alcoholics Anonymous 12 Steps and 12 Traditions that says pain is a touchstone to all spiritual progress. If I'm living in the space of the principles of the 12 steps and I get into a painful situation, if I can be present enough and in the moment enough to say, there's a gift here for me, let me look for the gift instead of looking at the pain, then the pain is greatly lessened because I know that it's brought something with us. Richard Bach says in the book Illusions, this is a paraphrase, but he says there is no such thing as a problem that doesn't have a gift in his hands for you. If I can really wrap my mind and my heart around that, then I can look at the pain, the distress, whatever you want to call it that I'm going through. It's like, okay, when I first met you and I was going to the mental health ward and then to the homeless shelter, there was one thing because of my Course in Miracles training that helped me get through that. And as periodically, I would have a very brief moment of clarity where I could say to myself, Johnny, someday you're going to see the gift in this. That was very fleeting. I couldn't hold on to that for 2 minutes to save my life. But that instant that I would have that thought, I could breathe. I could relax, as we talk about. Even if it was just an instant, it got me through. It's going to be a gift. Just hang on. I say that, and then I'm going to tie in my analogy. I love to connect the correlation of the life cycle of the butterfly to, typically I use it for the addict, but I believe it's for a human being. As a caterpillar, it just eats and eats and eats and eats and eats. And then at some point it says, to hell with it, man. I'm done. I've eaten all I can eat. And it hangs upside down and it consumes itself with a cocoon. Now, in my mind today, that is so symbolic of what we go through. We go through all the shit we can go through trying to run our lives on our own. And then at some point we say, man, I'm done. And we surrender. And then once we go into that cocoon, what happens is a process of the third to the 11th step. And we face our fears in that darkness. We face the darkness. And when we come out the other side, we get to live the 12th step. And we get to be as the butterfly is. The amazing thing about a butterfly for me is it doesn't take anything from anything. The little bit of nectar that it takes and pollen that it takes from one flower, it takes it over to another flower and shares it. That's what we do with our 12th step. And we become givers instead of the takers we lived our lives as. That is so incredible to me, man. I mean, I wasn't giving you anything before I found the rooms of the 12 steps that there wasn't a payoff in it for me. It's an amazing life I get to live today.
Amen.
And that's not to say that I don't have fears. That's not to say that sometimes I don't have to look at the whatever's going on in my life and say, okay, Johnny, somehow this is a gift. You just got to let go and get through it and not try to fight my way through it. Because whenever I try to fight my way into the next step, I ain't getting there. There's a line in the Course in Miracles that a lot of people just don't understand. It says, readiness is not mastery. I can't make myself be ready to walk through the next door. All I can do is do the best I can to let go and allow myself to just go through the door. But when I start trying to push that door open, the resistance itself stops the door from opening.
Kierkegaard said, love is jumping off a cliff and building wings on the way down.
Who said that?
Kierkegaard.
Wow.
That's pretty good, isn't it?
Yeah. Hey, man, we have run out of time. That was a good one, man. They're all good.
Pleasure to be here.
Yeah.
Let me just say one thing. The previous times I've given my contact information from my scientist and my clinical side. Today, I'm going to invite everybody to check out the other way that I have approached truth, which is with music. And so if you are interested in hearing some of these concepts that we've talked about today in music, then I would invite you to check out our songs on Clean Music. That's KLEEN. music.com.
Oh, great, great, cool. Because I love your music, and I'd love for other people to hear it. That'd be wonderful.
Yeah, me too.
And we're going to, we'll be having Eric back, and I just started a new Morph Into a New You group on Facebook. Please look us up and join, and we'll be having a dialogue going on there. We'll be talking about everything from addiction, bipolar, depression, child abuse, surviving child abuse. We'll be talking about all of it. So, but no, I'm not a doctor. I won't be giving you advice. I'll just be sharing my strength, hope, and experience on that show. And we'll have people such as Eric on there periodically answering questions. And I'm excited about where we're going with that. So this is Johnny of Morph Into a New You, changing thoughts to change lives. Look for us on johnnycalloway.com. You can hear all the other podcasts I've done with Eric. Okay, guys, thank you very much. Okay, everybody, thanks for listening. Remember, never give up. Always keep it real and take time to smell the roses. And please sit down and watch a butterfly. Keep up with all that we are doing by going to morphintoanewyou.com. Thank you very much.